Hello, everyone, and welcome. Thank you for joining IMPACTS's Invest in Women Symposium. I am your host, Kelly Baldoni, and we are about to begin our third session of the day, which is on implementing a gender lens strategy. For anyone who's just joined today's events, a quick recap on logistical items before we move into the panel session. You will be in listen-only mode, but we encourage you to ask questions in the Q&A box at any time during the session. At the end, we'll do our best to get to those questions. And if you have a question for a specific person on the panel, please note that in your question. If you experience any technical issues, drop us a note in the chat box and someone from IMPACTS will assist you right away. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Kylie Miller, Director of ESG Investment Solutions at Envestnet, who is going to be our moderator for this next session.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for being here. And thank you to our esteemed panelists for sharing your insights with us. I'm so excited for this conversation. So this session is all about gender lens strategies. And I think this is particularly relevant right now as we're witnessing a record number of women leaving the workforce since the pandemic hit. COVID has given us a new set of challenges, one being the great resignation that's affecting women more than men. And in many ways, this has really demonstrated how important it is to make sure that companies are giving women the resources and support that they need to succeed. And gender lens strategies really give us a way and a mechanism to invest in this way with our dollars. So there was some pre-session polling of the audience before the session today, and it looks like the majority of you have been investing in gender lens strategies for at least a few years. So we know that there's definitely some existing knowledge and familiarity in this area. And because of that, I think that we can spend less time level setting and more time really digging into some specifics. So our goal today and our hope is that through this conversation, we can provide you with some really actionable insights on trends, on how to navigate the various approaches to gender lens, how to build and implement portfolios in this way, and then talk about really what the future looks like in this space. So with that, I'll keep it brief and let's definitely kick things off. Jackie, I want to start with you and just ask, how has investor interest in gender lens really taken shape over the last few years? And you know, what is really the opportunity set here? What are you seeing from clients?
Yeah, thanks, Kylie. Appreciate the chance to be here and really looking forward to this conversation. So I think that if we think about the interest, first off from clients, it started with much more the activist set, right? We initially saw the women's funds leading, women who were out in front had done gender lens philanthropy, really moving over and starting to say, okay, I want to use my capital as well. Now what we see is a much more inclusive conversation with people who are, whether they're just saying, I want to pay this forward, this has been something that has mattered to me in my life. It's part of my experience as an individual in the workforce that inclusive teams perform better. And so I'm looking in that direction. And some of that being much more from a risk reduction standpoint than even I want to have a particular outcome that I'm focused on. That said, we do see some great anchors, from family offices who've been really clear about leading and from foundations. So that continues to be part of the space. I think it, increasingly in some sense, I might call it the same way we see with the solutions. It's wider and deeper, right? The solutions, the broad-based gender solutions, which we can talk about, are more being used more broadly. And then we're seeing some really interesting innovations, whether that is activists, funds using a gender lens or other approaches, and that gets much deeper.
That's great. Thank you, Jackie. So Deborah, given kind of what Jackie has just laid out around the evolution of the space, you're an allocator that's really able to see kind of the entire landscape of available strategies. What types of approaches are out there for investors and are the trends that you're seeing, similar or different?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you for having me here. I'm really excited to have this conversation. I'm just going to echo off of what Jackie had to say first before I talk a little bit more about the landscape for gender lens. My clients are predominantly endowments, foundations, and high private wealth clients, and they all have a growing interest in this. But Our most recent client survey showed that 30% of our client base considers gender equity in their investment decisions. And while that sounds like a low number, that's nearly triple the number of institutions that consider gender since the same survey was done just 2 years ago. This reflects a lot of client interest that's growing in terms of ESG, which I think a lot of us are also seeing. 2 years ago, 35% of my client base was doing something in the way of ESG investing, but that has doubled over the last 2 years, and more than 60% of our client base wants to do something. Climate is still the number one value that they're looking for, but right behind it is social equity and inclusion. And as part of that trend, we're seeing a huge desire to invest with women and diverse managers. So in terms of the landscape and what we're seeing in terms of solutions and opportunity sets, I'd like to just say the number of gender lens offerings and assets invested across all asset classes is growing. And the space has obviously evolved. Jackie talked a little bit about this. You know, 10 years ago, an offering might have just counted women on boards. Today, the data is better. Our panelists from the prior session were talking about how it's not great, but it is better than it used to be. But it's more granular, more robust, and you can get a more impactful opportunity set. So I'm going to highlight three major areas of growth in the gender lens community that I'm seeing my clients interested in. The first is, I would call it more the traditional stuff, global equities and fixed income. And depending upon how you slice it, and there are a couple of different organizations out there who talk about how many products are out there, but there's probably more than 50 strategies out there with more than $10 billion in assets. These strategies incorporate the usual metrics, number of women on boards, women in the C-suite, what's the makeup of the employee base. But they're also looking for companies that are taking a proactive approach and advancing gender equality, such as better family leave policies or addressing the gender pay gap, trying to eliminate non-disclosure agreements for sexual harassment, that sort of stuff. Many of these products have strong shareholder engagement teams focused on compelling these companies towards change. And some of these offerings are in a passive construction, but a lot are also active portfolio managers who are looking at fundamental analysis, and they're incorporating these metrics and asking very hard questions of the companies that they're investing with to try and get them to change. So that's one area. Another area I would call the privates area. So this is private capital, private equity, venture capital, private credit. And this is an investment that can create significant direct impact in the lives of women and girls. And according to Project Sage, there's more than 140 funds invested with more than $5 billion in assets most recently. And these funds are directly investing in companies such as a food company that sources ingredients from women, farmers, or a venture capital fund investing specifically in products and services addressing women's healthcare. Or it could be investing in companies to ease household burdens and caregiving, like solar powered stoves or hydro panels to save time on cooking and water collection. And then last but not least is access to capital. And these opportunities are investments with women portfolio managers across all of the asset classes, but it's also private equity venture capital funds that are getting capital into the hands of women. Women entrepreneurs, and a lot of them are diverse. So that's sort of the landscape as I see it.
That's super helpful. Thank you, Deborah. So Julie, just moving to you, would love to first just get your thoughts on the same question around the evolution of the space, maybe comment on those three major areas of growth that Deborah just touched on. And then also would love to get your take on the pandemic and how the pandemic has just made it more difficult for women to stay in the workforce and really what investors can do to address that in our portfolios.
Yeah, so there's a lot of learning that we've done in the gender space over the time that we've been in, and that really shows in the number of choices that we have and the varieties of investments that you can make. In terms of the pandemic, I'm going to be Debbie Downer for a second here. If we were looking for a perfect way to showcase the unequal division between men and women in household duties, childcare, and elder care, there is no better place to look than a pandemic. It is an unfortunate reality that viruses and other disease vectors find their best habitat in places where people mingle a lot, which means that the first thing you do in a pandemic, if you want to limit the spread, is you close the schools, which was done. Wasn't the first thing, but it was a thing, and it started pretty early. And when you do that, then you have a whole lot of children needing homeschooling, and that generally falls on women. Women take on roughly 3 times as much childcare in terms of time as men, and that really became very difficult for a lot of women during the pandemic. So there's the background, right? The pandemic was not good for women. What can companies do? I mean, the companies can't necessarily solve the pandemic, although there were a couple of them that really helped with vaccines. Under ordinary circumstances, companies that offer assistance with caregiving, whether it's in the form of child care subsidies or elder care subsidies, are probably going to be, or that's the most helpful thing that they can do. Obviously, pay equity is another helpful thing, and children are expensive. I can speak from personal experience. And it's, you know, the more there's a pay gap, the more there's a race gap or a racial gender gap in pay, the harder it is for women to weather things like crises. But just offering, you know, subsidies for childcare on site childcare isn't going to help much during the pandemic. You're still trying to keep people apart, including children. So I think a lot of the things that companies did during the pandemic, the ones that tried to adapt well, were in the form of sending signals to people that, hey, we still value your services. We're going to make it easier for you to have flexible working arrangements if you need to work different hours, because online schooling is when it is and you can't change that. Great. There are some counterexamples. There was an article in the New York Times about a company, I don't even know, remember which one, but there was a manager at this company that basically called the people who showed up for work during the pandemic warriors and called the people who worked from home slackers. And when you send signals like that, you're not necessarily making, you know, the women who are doing the home care and home ed schooling feel welcome or feel like they're really valued by the company. So a lot of times, you know, the things that you do to increase flexibility, really not, it's not just a matter of giving people the arrangements that they need, it's saying to the person, you're valuable. And again, we still need to solve the gender pay gap, which is getting smaller, but we went backwards during the pandemic. We need to get back on track. I should also mention that all the challenges women face during the pandemic are even more daunting for women of color. So this isn't, you know, there are even differences between white women and women of other races and ethnicities that we also need to address.
That's great. Thank you, Julie. And sticking with you, just moving more into kind of opportunities, right? So as an asset manager, you know, what do you really see as the kind of investment case for Gender Lens? How can this way of investing really offer portfolio resilience in an economy that's in transition in a pandemic? And, you know, said another way, are Gender Lens strategies really delivering on that, this idea that diversity drives alpha? And I know you all have done some research around this.
We have, yeah, thanks. So the academic and financial literature that I look at, I've been keeping studies that link various aspects of sustainability, including gender and other forms of diversity, to financial outcomes for 2 decades, and I've got about 1,000 of them now. So there is robust evidence in that literature that companies that do better in terms of diversity also tend to do better over the long run in financial outcomes. Does that mean they can't underperform? Of course not. Show me a fund that underperforms under every circumstance, and I will grant you that you should be, that it should get the official recognition as a miracle. It doesn't usually happen. And in the fact, the literature itself isn't even monolithic. So there are studies that show that having more women or being taking steps to embrace diversity doesn't always outperform. But the ratio of studies that show outperformance or comparable performance is vastly higher than the is much higher than the number of studies that show underperformance. So you can basically take it as a sort of reflection of at least three decades worth of literature that you don't give up any returns by including diversity in your investment discipline. And you are more likely to outperform than underperform, but you can probably expect comparable performance. Now, there are several themes in the business case literature. 20 years ago, the typical study was, you know, I'm going to link Tobin's Q to the percentage of women on the board. And you would see some positive correlation and some, you know, studies that concluded that there was no impact and a few that said it was negative. It is much richer now. There are more and more themes in the literature and they're really helpful. They help us to explain, well, why would you see outperformance? It's not just a correlation. It's like looking deeper and saying, is there a reason why this is happening? Or is it like the famous correlation between skirt lengths and Wall Street's performance? So first and foremost, among those, heterogeneous groups do a better job than homogeneous groups. They don't suffer from groupthink. They tend to produce more options for decisions and vet them more thoroughly than groups that do have groupthink in them. This operates at many levels, from the C-suite, the board, R&D groups, any employee association or group, and even all the way down to local governments and village co-ops, harkening back to some of the stuff that Deborah said about the impact funds. Secondly, sexism and discrimination are costly, and more studies are really showing that. So companies whose CEOs took part in sexual misconduct tended to lose a few percentage points in terms of their market value, and that continued for at least a year or two after. So there is reputational risk, and there is a sort of consensus among the investors that if you're the kind of company that not only puts up with that, but puts up with the CEO doing it, you probably don't have a great culture. Companies have to take advantage of all their talent in order to do well in these increasingly competitive times. There's also a lot of studies that correlate things like better human capital management, more innovation, and more likelihood to lighten environmental footprints in companies that embrace diversity. So the literature is getting, you know, much more interesting and covering many more topics, and it is increasingly supporting the investors who want to indulge in or want to integrate gender. Overall, in terms of selection and performance, the gender leadership did help in tech. It gets overwhelmed by these mega cap performance. Sorry to go on so long.
No, that was great. Really, really helpful. So we have this kind of value proposition, Julie, that you outlined. And now I kind of want to get practical implementation. So Deborah, just pivoting to you, you know, how can we really build comprehensive and diversified portfolios that are aligned with a gender lens approach, given we have this value proposition?
Right, and I'm gonna double click a little bit on what Julie had to say, because if you are building an entire portfolio across a lot of different asset classes, you would want the people who are managing that money to have diversified views and viewpoints, experiences, networks, which is why from a risk perspective and from an opportunity perspective, we focus a lot on diversity, whether it's gender lens investing or investing with people of color. So I think that's very important to mention again. Returns will be better. We wholeheartedly believe that. But in terms of portfolio implementation, it's no different than we would with any other client, actually. Portfolio implementation starts with the policy statement. And if in this case you are concerned about women, children, and equality, those conversations should be incorporated into discussions with your client and with the policy statement. And that policy statement outlines the client's purpose, priorities, and principles. And this serves as the roadmap and guides and focuses clients towards aligning their values with their portfolios and with their risk tolerance levels, right? It also serves as a guideline for selecting the funds that meet the risk and return objectives of the client. So it's no different than we would with anyone else. And I will agree with Julie that gender lens investing is delivering on our clients' investment and risk objectives.
Great, thank you. And Jackie, how do you kind of think about, you know, this very similar question, you know, thinking about the value proposition and really helping clients build holistic gender lens portfolios.
I think, Kylie, what struck me is Deborah and Julie were talking is, again, the shift over time, right? That, yes, it's true. I think, and we're a large platform, so we see a lot of gender lens funds come across, and a lot of them do still fit in that mostly leadership focused, but that increase of the breadth and depth and the interesting piece and the intersection with diversity and with climate allows for that building out based on, as Deborah said, the purpose, priorities, and principles. We see a lot of clients who are, gender may be their North Star, but they've got climate funds all through their portfolio because they see that intersection. And I would love, Julie, to probably go deeper on this, but we saw some data showing that of companies that were considered SDG 5 aligned, and this is a really loose, we've got a lot of work to do to say who's really aligned and positive, but that they had, a 21% improvement on the environmental side. Now, again, the data is all, this is just directional, but that piece of, the intersection between gender and climate, so much clearer now. And also sort of that broad piece in terms of blowing out diversity. And I'll just, personal experience, right? The Bank of America issued a $2 billion equality progress bond last week. This is our second. In the first equality progress bond, it was very focused around inclusion on racial lines. The second gender equality progress bond expanded that. So it's still absolutely focuses there, but it's the equality and economic opportunity is now for, what's defined as historically marginalized populations, including people of color and women, right? And women and that process was now in there. So the more specifically, it was not that it wasn't there last year, this year, it's just much more rigorous and much more of a focus in terms of what they were doing across all the lines of business. So I think that's those two pieces of what to me has changed for gender lens investors is they are thinking still about gender as the center, but are much more likely to have that integration with other themes.
Absolutely. And Deborah, I know you recently wrote a paper on the intersection of climate change and social inequality. So we'd just love to better understand how you're thinking about that intersection of gender and other sustainability issues. Yeah.
So Jackie and I are on the same page here. So yeah, I just recently published this article on the intersection of climate and social justice. And I wrote the article because a lot of our clients are climate focused and a lot are social justice focused, but they weren't necessarily seeing the intersection. So I wanted to bring to light that climate is a gender issue. The vast majority of people who will be harmed by climate are women, people of color, people in developing countries. So I argue that rather than viewing the solutions to these problems through distinct lens, that investors should approach them intersectionally. So the paper also goes on to talk about how you would implement that in the portfolio and how we're seeing a lot of opportunities to invest with that lens in funds that are investing in companies that address racial, gender, geographic, health, environmental. So we see a lot of interesting funds that are investing in reversing type 2 diabetes or asthma, which are two diseases that disproportionately affect the underprivileged, or addressing food insecurity. Many of these opportunities are also managed by women and people of color. And that turns us back to the idea of access to capital, which is a huge driver of a lot of our clients' interests over the last 2 years, trying to get funds in the hands of, for example, diverse portfolio managers. Cambridge has pledged to double the number of assets and the double number of managers that are diverse or gender in the next 5 years. So we're well on the way to achieving that goal, I'm happy to say.
Great, congratulations, that's awesome. Julie,
Kylie, just one other thing, and I'd be curious, Deborah, Julie, if you see this, but just on that intersection, the UN just published this research showing that gender-based violence really increased over the pandemic, which is the other side to, Julie, what you were talking about, you know, increased caregiving, but also increased violence. And in there, they were talking about the fact that employed women see less violence, right? That you get to that power piece. But I'm just curious how you're seeing the research from that perspective, because I know there are a lot of investors out there that have also looked at sort of that human rights slash violence lens in terms of what's happening.
Climate change is regarded as a threat multiplier by most of the world's departments of defense. I mean, Australia said that, the US said that. There's the fact that there has always been gender-based violence, and the fact that as the world gets warmer, violence between any group of people, or even any two people, tends to go up. It tends to displace people, and then you end up with migration, and that increases violence. So these things are not separate problems. They are very much part and parcel of the same thing. We have to learn how to have a sustainable world, how to live sustainably, how to live and how to make a low carbon economy, how to make a more equal society. And then solving any of the problems we have on the globe will be much easier than if we go at them one by one.
So Julie, I wanted to pivot back to you again and just ask you about kind of the future of this space and where you think we go from here. I know you've outlined a number of challenges. How do you think that we address them as investors? Where do we go from here?
The future of gender lens investing is bright. The future of sustainable investing is bright. I think the more sophisticated we get in the investment world, the more we see these as not separable, separate sort of discrete themes. They are in fact linked. Sustainability is always going to be a journey, and it's going to involve multiple points of tangency between, you know, investment and societal problems. So I can see gender lens funds expanding into what we call sustainable investing, and sustainable investing being more, they all say that they embrace gender, but it's not clear how often. So I think that there's going to be more and more of a melding, more sophistication in the understanding of what sustainability means in terms of the way you select investments for your portfolio, how you weight them, and how you engage with them. So I think it's going to affect all of the parameters of sustainability. And you can kind of see that when you look at proxy voting. So you look at who there every year, Majority Report does a thing on who voted how in proxy voting. I know Ceres just published a report on that. And I think it's interesting if you look at the overlaps between how fund managers vote on various issues on the proxy, usually coming up from shareholders in shareholder resolutions, on climate and gender, you find a lot of overlap, which you should. They are linked problems.
Thanks, Julie. And maybe just for the three of you, I'm going to throw this out to the broader group. You know, there was, I think the previous panel was about kind of the lack of you know, gender and DEI disclosure, the data gap and concerns there. So wanted to see if any of you had kind of reactions to that or any thoughts.
Getting better from an abysmal base. So it is not yet what we want it to be, but it's better than it used to be. It's going to have to be mandated, I think, in order to be universal and comparable. Right now, there are two countries that mandate pay gap reporting, and one of them doesn't make it public, and both of them are partial data. So we have a long ways to go.
I think one of the things I heard the prior panel talking about was the role of investors and how investors are pushing the needle a lot. And as an allocator, we take it very seriously. We are pushing our asset owners to ask these questions. Why isn't your team diversified? And then when you're looking at companies, what questions are you asking of them? Are you asking and voting proxies in such a way to move the needle? So our objective is to take our bully pulpit and push the needle as much as possible. We're beginning to see some strides. I don't know whether you saw, but BlackRock's allowing institutional commingled funds now to vote according to their wishes. And it used to be you couldn't as an investor if you were in a commingled vehicle. So that's a huge bonus. So you can invest according to ISS sustainability rules if you want to. I think it's coming slowly, but it's coming.
I would agree. I mean, I think that if you merge this with sort of the question you asked, Julie, of, you know, where are we going? The theme that you can hear really clearly is it used to be much more boxed, right? Both in terms of gender and in terms of the investment process. And now that box has kind of gotten exploded. And we're not just asking about the investment process, but we're asking about the team. We're not just asking about the team, we're asking about the firm. And so that, you know, and some of the teams and firms that come and present to us say, you know, by the way, we would want to be covered by a diverse team, right? So they're actually asking the same thing, right? In terms of their service providers and understanding the way in which, as Deborah said, where, you know, what is the lever that is within our control and how do we wield it to create more of, you know, ripples in the ecosystem that we play in.
Yeah, absolutely. A question that just kind of popped into my head related to that. So we're just seeing so many public announcements from companies, right, about, you know, how they're going to improve in terms of diversity. How, and again, this is for all three of you, if any of you have thoughts, but just how can we kind of hold companies accountable for meeting their diversity targets and their goals, you know, thinking about things like tying executive pay to diversity. You know, we're going to obviously have to see these things play out over time, but how do we kind of instill that accountability mechanism for all of these different targets and goals that we're seeing from companies?
So I'm going to sound like a broken record for a second, but we need the numbers. You can say everything you want about how much you believe in diversity, but if you can't show that you actually don't have a pay gap, or you actually have, you know, that the field of participants as you go up every level of management gets more and more male dominated, especially in a world where women are getting more degrees every year at all three levels, bachelor's, master's, PhD, than men. That's been the case for more than two decades. You know, so the numbers don't lie and we need those, and it really helps, right? I mean, the good intentions are one thing, you know, like good achievements are better. And when it comes to linking executive pay to really anything in ESG, if it's 5% of your bonus, it doesn't mean squat, to be perfectly honest. It has to be a real part of pay that really affects the incentives of executives, not just the difference between a big Christmas present and a little one.
I think just adding on to Julie's comment about we need the numbers, we also need the baseline and the ongoing diligence, right? So I think most of the due diligence firms on the street, I know ours did, made announcements over the last 2 years. We were doing it before we were allowed to announce it, but, you know, of really integrating that process of understanding the diversity of a team and of a firm into the due diligence of all strategies, not just of sustainable strategies. But I'll tell you from the inside perspective of what it took to be able to get to an announcement, you have to go through a whole set of governance committees and really make the case that this is an economic argument, right? That we are going to understand the diversity of a team and of a firm, and we're gonna put them on notice that we need that to be on an improving scale, right? That has to be changing over time. And if it's not, that is absolutely going to be considered a risk, you know, from the perspective of the due diligence team.
I see Kelly just turned on her video. So I think we're at time, but thank you so much to our panelists. I think we're gonna move into some Q&A.
Yes, thank you, Kylie and everybody for those comments. We have about a little less than 10 minutes for questions. So if you haven't already, please ask some in the Q&A box. We've had a few come in that I'm gonna probably just kind of group together for all three of you, I think, would have a response to this. You've been in the space, you know, since it started, basically, since the term gender lens investing was coined. Can you comment on the adoption and just assets kind of flowing into these gender lens strategies? Sally Krawcheck mentioned something on the first session today, which is just you know, why isn't it more widely adopted? You know, if we're all kind of in agreement on the research and the business case, it's not yet mainstream. So comments on just what you've seen since it's begun to where we're at now.
And I'll start because I remember being on a panel with Joe Keefe a number of years ago where, you know, he was like, yep, we need innovation. And we actually also need asset flows, right? We need to support the strategies that are out there that have the track records and the teams behind them. So, I mean, I guess, Kelly, I would say it's yes and, right? It is no longer smaller than a bread box, as Deborah mentioned, right? You know, whether you want to call it at the 11 billion and 5 billion or however, you know, if you want to use US SIF numbers, the number is $1 trillion of assets incorporates gender in some way. Now, whether that, you know, what is incorporation is a big black box, as we all know, but that's a much bigger number than used to say black box incorporated gender. So that is increasing. But yes, I mean, part of it is, you know, the both investors demanding and also asset managers getting and really putting distribution forces behind strategies. Because while we've seen growth in assets, it's been dominated by a few passive strategies, especially in the US. Now you can look to Europe. I just have much more of a US context.
Yeah, I think another way of looking at it is not just the interest among investors and the investment, the financial community in gender equality is much broader than the simple universe of funds that has gender lens in the title or that says, you know, this is a gender fund. If you look at proxy voting trends, you will see that. When I first started filing shareholder resolutions, people were hunting mammoths back then. I would get these calls occasionally from reporters who would say, well, can you prove to me that women would be as good at being on boards as men are? This was like 2001, 2002. And it's kind of like, you know, we just had WorldCom send in, you know, the Enron, you know, we just had a governance failure in this country. Can you please prove to me that women would be any worse? That question is gone. You see big firms voting proxies for diverse slates, voting against all male slates, wanting more than tokenism on the board. So I think looking at gender lens from a broader perspective shows that it is more increasingly accepted in investment circles that gender diversity and other forms of diversity are actually additive to companies' performance and quality of management. Just because a fund isn't labeled a gender fund doesn't mean that it doesn't think about or use gender data or gender parameters in overall fund management and engagement.
Thanks, Julie. I think we have time for one more. And Deborah, maybe you could get us started with responding to this question, which is around navigating that intersectionality piece that we've heard you guys talk about now a few times during the conversation, but it just seems like we started with gender and now investors are kind of wanting and maybe demanding these additional diversity lenses or a climate lens. So I think everybody should read your paper, Deborah, but then how else would you recommend folks kind of navigate these client requests as it relates to the intersectionality piece?
Well, I think the beauty of this is that you get to broaden your perspective and open the definitions. Sometimes, you know, it doesn't have to be women own 50% of the fund. It could be 33%, and they could be focusing on a variety of different topics, not including climate and racial justice. So I actually think it actually opens the periscope and you get a more richer variety of opportunity sets. And as an allocator, we're just asking all those questions. A lot of climate managers I see aren't measuring gender. And I tell them, but you know, the effects of what you are doing is actually going to have a disproportionate effect on women. To the positive, why aren't you measuring this? And they'll go, oh, I hadn't thought about it. So then you wind up with new views and new perspectives. So I think we're getting a more richer, diverse set of opportunity sets, actually, by opening your lens a little bit more and realizing that there are lots of interconnected pieces. And I think people have thought this way, ESG, what is ESG? You know, it's a wide variety of things, but it is an intersectionality. Gender lens was one piece of that. We're pulling back a few more of the values and alignments with it, with this approach. I'm not sure I answered the question.
No, that was great. Any other kind of ways I would ask maybe Julie and Jackie to chime in that folks can, you know, stay up to speed, stay educated on allocating to diverse and gender lens strategies? Like, is there research tools that, you know, you guys are providing? And Kylie, feel free to chime in on this as well. I know, you know, InvestNet's platform offers a lot of these tools.
Verus. They do reports every year on gender strategies and what's happening in gender strategies. Those are always interesting to catch up on. Morningstar will have the occasional piece. There's lots of places where you can just, if you just Google gender lens investing, there's always something interesting and new to read. It's kind of the way I stay up with the literature and everything else. I just sort of stay voraciously out there on the web with an increasingly, hopefully, precise set of search terms and find a lot of interesting stuff. There's no silver bullet. You know, you just have to be curious and read what you find.
Yeah, I think from my perspective, working with advisors, there's a common misconception that these strategies are thematic and thus they're like a satellite to a portfolio allocation, right? And the reality is a lot of gender lens strategies or, you know, other climate strategies, what have you, can be a core component of your portfolio depending on the approach, right? So you can build a diversified portfolio using these strategies. Sounds simple, but a lot of advisors don't necessarily, know that. And I think when you're looking at these approaches, you know, we just hear a lot in the media about greenwashing and, you know, just a lot of positioning and misleading, statements like that. But I think understanding the objectives of the strategy and making sure the manager is actually delivering on those objectives, are they really doing what they say they are? And are they reporting on outcomes, things like that? Those are good places to start. Again, it's simple, but good places to start to better understand if the manager's approach is aligned with what your client might need. Whether it's gender lens, whether it's climate, whether it's broader ESG.
I would agree with that misconception, Kylie. I'm really glad you called that out, that gender lens strategies are only satellites, because that's absolutely out there. And Kelly, that there is some regular reports, the Project Sage that was already mentioned, some other annual reports that come out. But I think that the other piece is all of these intersectional plays, whether it's, thematic research that comes out from UN Women or McKinsey or any of the others that you had today is really great research to kind of pull together. But then you have to ask Kylie, as Kylie said, to any given strategy. So how are you using this, right? If this is the research that we understand about whether it's teams or power or health or violence or whatever, then what does that mean in terms of your particular investment thesis and how can you report on it?
Great. Well, I think with that, we are at the end of the session time-wise. So thank you so much, Kylie, for moderating, Julie, Jackie, and Deborah for such an interesting conversation, and to our audience, of course, for listening. We now have about a 15-minute break, so we hope you'll join us back on our next session. There's actually two starting at 3 p.m. Eastern. One is intended for financial advisors on how to accelerate your business, and the other is a conversation with the Girl Scouts on their exciting new pay equity initiative and a conversation on EDI measurement and reporting. So you'll have to close out of this session to rejoin one of those, and those links should be in your email. So thank you all again, and hope to see you again in about 15 minutes.